I ended up doing 6 operational deployments, yeah. I mean, the flight in from Bastion to Sangin was the reason I don't like roller coasters today. Yeah. It was doing everything, the evasive manoeuvres. For those who could see out of a window...
You've got 200 bullets you're just firing out within how long?
Courage is being terrified, but doing it anyway. I don't think I've ever shared this. 8th of October 2008, 5:45 in the afternoon, my world stopped.
Welcome to the Eventful Lives podcast. I'm your host, Dodge, and I'm the founder of Bournemouth Sevens, the world's largest sport and music festival. On this podcast, I speak to proper characters of all lived eventful lives. Do us a favour and hit that follow button and be sure to check us out on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook and TikTok at Dodge Woodall, where we've now had over 100 million views. Nick Goldsmith is a former Royal Marine Commando. Serving in Afghan, Nick talks through his 6 operational tours that saw him nearly blown up, shot at, and even ambushed on 3 separate occasions. He describes the events of fighting against over 2,000 jihadists and firing 600 rounds a minute. This is the eventful life of Mr. Nick Goldsmith. Nick, welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to this one. This is a different one. Let's roll all the way back. Where did you grow up and how did you end up doing 6 tours as a Royal Marine Commando?
I grew up at a very rural upbringing in East Sussex. So around the area of Uckfield Lewis, there's a little village called Buxted. And that was me growing up there. Played a lot of rugby to a fairly decent standard. Played for my county. Was lucky enough to captain the county a handful of times. That was all good. And to my mind, I was on that lineage to go on to bigger, better things, you know, at that sort of young teenage 16-year-old version of myself. Professional rugby was a thing that I could go and do. I wasn't overly academic, not for lack of, you know, my teachers trying to get the work out of me, like getting blood from a stone, but I just wanted to be outdoors. My head was outdoors. I was looking outside. I'd spend every lunchtime playing rugby. I think at one point, sort of 5 days a week, 6 days a week, whether it was club, county, school, whatever it was. Mm. So that was my focus. That gave me a sense of, an earlier sense of esprit de corps, you know, a team stuff. And so I was a very team orientated individual, but I could lead. If I was given the window and the opportunity, I would step
what
up.
What year are we talking here when you're 16, 17, 18?
Maths was definitely not my forte. What am I now, 37? So we're talking...
Yeah, 20 years ago, early 2000s.
Early 2000s, okay, yeah. So okay. I tell you, a college squad, as I was leaving, the year I left, well, during that year, we had a young first year by the name of Mr. Joseph Marler. You've met. And we played against on a weekly basis at that point a Mr. Dylan Hartley, who you've also met. So it was that kind of peerage.
Okay.
And it didn't happen for me. I didn't get picked up by the selectors.
What position were you?
I was a 6.
Okay.
Started off as a 7, went 6. And then I had a little go at hooking right towards the end. I think at that point Dylan was a prop. So we did meet once or twice in the scrum.
Yeah.
But they had a hooker called Phil at the time who was keeping Dylan a prop.
Yeah.
And then those lads went on to
big things.
Incredible. Amazing. So I found myself feeling that sort of, what do I do now?
Yeah.
So I say that many times in our lives, we find ourselves going back around the learning tree and going, right, so that hasn't worked out. What do I do now? Who am I now? You know, almost like a little mini identity.
Yeah.
And my mum, being a good mum, saw that I was a bit lost, took me to see my cousin James, who'd just done 5 years as a Royal Marine Commando. So we went down to their place, which is in just outside Lewis. Name is escaping me right now. Anyway, went down to this little lovely farmhouse, opened a kitchen door, and there's a wooden beam running through the middle of their house. Barkham. And on there is a picture with 2 Chinooks helicopters and a bunch of guys all in black, submachine guns and green berets on their heads. And just straight away, that sort of level of imprinting, which happens in a young man.
Yeah.
I went, yeah, that's it. That's what I want. High performance teams. I want to be back in a high performing team. Yeah. I want to be a valued member of a team. What's this about? That's before I'd even sat down with him.
Yeah.
90 minutes later, I come out. And at this point, I'm sort of 16 stone, seven lump. I'm playing a lot of rugby and I'm built for 80 minutes on the pitch and all that sort of stuff. Mm. But I then had to change my physiology. I had to really focus and knuckle down on that endurance side of things. Yeah. So I straight away applied. The call came back and on the medical forms, can't touch it. You've had a knee op within a year. I was like, oh, so I needed a plan B in the interim. Spoke to my parents. Mum, being a mum, wasn't keen on the idea because Afghan was raging. Yeah. We were seeing it in the news.
Yeah.
Which obviously just drew me even further towards that sense of adventure.
But you're thinking, I want a piece of that. I want to get out there.
I think growing up in a small village
yeah.
with a U-shaped high street,
yeah.
one church, one shop, two pubs. If you're not down the pub, they're talking about a day in the, down the pub.
Yeah.
It sort of lends itself to a certain... There's only so many things you can do
yeah.
without getting into the naughty stuff yeah. and going down a route.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need adventure. This is ticking every box, what I need right now. And now we're coming into my sort of 17, 18-year-old self. So my granddad, after World War II, he'd been a tail gunner in a Wellington and then in a Lancaster bomber. Mm. And he came out as a W01. I didn't know much about the military.
W01, what's that?
W01, he was a warrant officer first class
okay.
by the time he'd left.
The creme de la creme?
He got up there in the ranks, yeah, and come okay. out as a decent,
okay.
without you know going across to the dark side and becoming a full officer and all the rest of it. Yeah. So he built every stone in the church for the primary school I went to, the same primary school my dad went to. So it was all this kind of like, we're men of Uckfield and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I remember at the time, it just made total sense to follow. I needed a stopgap, so I went to learn to become a bricklayer. Mm. So I became a brickie. Did all of about five houses and realized that this was not for me more than ever. But at that point, I was running to site 5 to 8 miles a day with my trowel and my steel toe caps in my rucksack. So I was running from sort of a couple of times, Buxted to Piltdown. Don't know if you know that area. And then back again, I was running, working all day on site, then running home again, just building this massive battery power that I would later rely on when I got down to Limestone Commando. And then, as soon as the 2-year mark or whatever the thing was up, I said, right, I'm doing it. And I start the application process again. Now, this time, like everyone and their dog wants to be in the Corps because they've seen all the action.
Yeah.
All these young men want to go and get amongst it. So it takes quite a long time from Brighton Recruitment Office to get all the way through the SIFT, the medicals, the psychometric exams, all the rest of it. And I finally get to my week, at the time, it was a week-long look at life course, the potential Royal Marine Commando course. And I did that, came back absolutely rinsed. Like, no matter how hard I thought I'd trained.
Yeah.
Horrendous. Mm. So I came back and I'd managed to come top on that. So I'd really pushed. And so I thought that was going to set me up well for what would come in training. Come the day of the race, you arrive at Limestone Commando Training Center with your suit on, with all the other lads. You stand there at the train station and you have no idea what's about to hit you. You are entering the unknown.
Yeah.
A chap arrives there, smart as you like, it's the drill instructor, and he's got his lid on and he's got his cane and all the rest of it. And you're quite quickly whisked into the world of what's known as foundation.
Yeah.
So you do your foundation stage.
How long does that take?
At the time, it was 3-4 weeks. Okay. So you had to survive your first month.
Yeah.
And then already people were dropping. So we had 67 in our intake, taken from the best of, I don't know, the top 12, 15 of each one of these week-long courses, which probably had 40 to 60 lads on in itself. So the selection process was there. Mm. And then fast forward, 32 weeks, there's 11 of us left on the parade square, green berets on our heads. We've laughed, we've cried, we've seen each other in every single shape, size, format you can imagine in the middle. The names on the picture board there have been blacked out in marker pen. They're slowly disappearing week by week. And it's sad watching lads go as well, because some of them quit of their own accord. They've had enough, fair enough. Some of them, just bad luck. Like, you imagine you're lying there in a woodland on Dartmoor or whatever it is, 3 o'clock in the morning, the enemy, the notional enemy, your training team, they bump you, right? So off, all the blank firing starts going off, pyrotechnics, it's time to get up and go. You pick up your entire life on your back, which weighs bomb, and you're sprinting wildly through the undergrowth whilst trying to do sort of a controlled fire maneuver to get to an emergency rendezvous point where you're all going to form up in a big circle with your legs all interlocked, facing outermost. Then the boss will make a decision from there and you'll move on.
Okay.
And imagine that some lad who's done really well, super athletic, intelligent, he's flying through basic training. Not that anyone really flies, but he's doing well.
Yeah.
And puts his foot in a rabbit hole, breaks an ankle. Yeah. That's you done.
Right, okay.
You know, it's as simple as that.
Career done.
So there is a there is an element of luck as well as skill and a boatload of determination, because a lot of it is all head games. A lot of it is... I just remember some of the funny being told on some one of the exercises we did. We were in Wales and we're all holed up in this little farmhouse and it's freezing. Everyone's wet through and we're just on this, getting us into this routine of always having a couple of guys keeping an eye out on the sentry. And the training team come in and sort of shake you all up psychologically and then walk out again. So they'll be like, oh, David Beckham's had a car accident and he's touch and go in hospital and Posh Spice has lost their leg. And they tell you all this stuff from the outside world. You're totally cut off. Mm. You haven't got a clue. So you're all like, oh, and you're all gossiping amongst yourselves about what's gone on. Of course, you come back and find that it's all just made up.
Yeah.
But then they'll also say, lads, if you do really well on this exercise, you'll go home this weekend. You only get to go home about four times in commando training in 9 months. And I just remember thinking to myself, this isn't real.
Yeah.
They won't let us have this weekend. So like I didn't allow myself to even have it on the shelf. Some lads had rung their family to come meet them on the train station and all sorts. And of course, when we got back, they would find one thing, one tiny discrepancy with your equipment and it's one in all in. Right, leave's cancelled. And you just watch blokes sitting on their bed, crying their eyes out. Just overcome with emotion where they were so sure they were going to have this respite from the constant mounting pressure. But it's all about that dislocation of expectation. It's preparing you for what really happens in the real world.
For you, when you were doing that, when you passed, what was your first tour?
Herrick 9, which was it's quite a juicy one, 2008. So you've probably interviewed people who've been in around that time. Mm. And so that's when a lot of stuff was going off. And I'm going to go as far as to say of everybody I know, I still speak to from that time, I don't think there's a single individual that hasn't been affected adversely.
Really?
by the level of exposure to all the stuff we were doing, by the sheer pace, the ops pace.
What country are we talking in here?
Afghanistan.
So you went straight in Afghan in 2008.
To a place called Sangin. So 2008, 2009. Yeah. I think it's Wikipedia. It's the bloodiest year of the conflict.
Yeah,
so,
I remember.
So yeah, it was very, very.
What was that like? Time. How old were you when you were at roughly 2008?
21.
21.
So 21 years of age. 21, 22.
Okay.
21, 22.
And you were straight into the mix in Afghan. What was it like coming off the plane, landing, and how long were you there for?
So my first tour, I did half a tour, got injured and had to go back, which then turned into another thing, which we'll discuss in a moment. I remember arriving. I remember the flying in. To a degree, it's no different, apart from you're in uniform and you know you've got body armor and helmets and stuff, to a regular aeroplane that you'd expect to be on. I can't remember the name of the bird now. It's RAF model. You all face the other way. It's weird because you're taking. I'm facing this way, and we're taking.
Oh, I see. Is that right? Is
it? Yeah. I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
And just as you're coming in for that last piece, all the lights go red. Everything. You're just on red light only. Everyone is silent, and you don your helmet and your body armor as you're flying into that last piece of the puzzle.
Wow.
And then you have to sit on the bird for a bit, and then you'll get taxied. By these sort of like little buses on this super base that was known as Bastion at the time into various accommodations, which would just be no more than a tent with a big air conditioning unit running through the center of it, all white on the inside and that kind of plastic bric-a-brac flooring.
Yeah, I know.
that you can, so say, really safe, but you trip on it every 2 minutes.
You said you were there for half a tour. What was the plan? Was the plan to be there 6 months, 7 months?
And plan was to be there for 6 months, okay, and then rip out. So we'd just taken over from the 2nd Battalion Parachute Regiment, and I'd had a lad I went to school with. He'd been the 100th man to be killed in the conflict. So he was killed by a suicide bomber. That was Private Daniel Gamble, B Company. And so I'd been on an exercise in one of the army bases in the UK, looking for notional IEDs and kind of going through all the processes, the final beat up stuff, when the signaller came over on his green army, or sort of on the military net, on the signals radio, and they've patched them through to my mum. And she basically told me there and then, they were like, you need to hear this. So they came out and found my particular troop out in the middle of the field with the boss, etc. Someone had a quick word with the boss, the captain, and then they were like, yeah, we need to speak to Goldsmith. So they pulled me over and they were like, Daniel Gamble died today, he was taken. And I remember I did the right thing at the time, which was just sat down, sat on my helmet, had a quick sob, like burst of emotion, put myself back together again because of where I was and who I was with, cracked on with the exercise. And then as quickly as possible, they released me because I'd only passed out of training sort of. Well, we both, Dan and I, started our respective trainings in the Parachute Regiment and the Marines around the same time. We'd finished around the same time. So I didn't have any medals or anything. And so my troop, the lads, made up a load of cardboard medals saying exercise. So like, I got a medal for final exercise, and like they'd just basically just done like a
quality.
And it wasn't until I got back home to Sussex, and I was getting ready to put my blues on to go and do, my Lovett's on to do this thing. I noticed all these medals on there, so I was laughing. So straight away, you know, that was not a nice bit of camaraderie for someone who's still finding their feet in that world.
Why did you only do half a tour?
I got injured.
Okay.
Yes.
And what was that feeling like when you were there for, were you there for 3 months, were you?
So I was there for, about 3 months,
What was that feeling like going into a war zone for 3 months? Did you ever feel like...
Unbelievable.
How did you feel in that zone? And you were 22 years old. Were you thinking, wasn't expecting this? Because you can train as much as you want.
Yeah, the training and conditioning takes you quite far.
But then you've got to be match fit to,
But the whole point of Limpstone Commando is so that you've got a product which can perform under pressure.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. So, you know, you sink to the level of your training.
Mm.
And that would get put to the test on the first day when we were quite violently ambushed at less than 50 meters by multiple individuals with AK variants. And so the world and its dog lit up around us. So we flew, the flight in from Bastion to Sangin was the reason I don't like roller coasters today. Yeah, it was doing everything and the evasive maneuvers.
Yeah.
For those who could see out of a window, they described it as like Star Wars
with
all the tracer going up, etc. So we sort of landed very, very briefly, ramp open, everything and everyone off, jump all over your equipment, big dust off, the thing takes off, and you want to get off the center of that helo pad, the area, as quickly as possible because it's exposed and there's things flying in. But the FOB itself had been under attack it'd been under siege for 24 hours as we were going in because the enemy knew that we were ripping.
Yeah.
The Irish Rangers and Parachute Regiment were ripping out, we were ripping in.
Right, okay.
So they were giving it a
big push. Is that how it works? It's like a tag team, is it? We're going into 6 month tag team. You go off skis.
But basically, just go flip-flop all the way through. And because the Royal Marines are such a small body of men, there's only 6,000 of us in the world at the time, you can almost guarantee that it's the same faces going out tour after tour after tour. So, like, I think my sergeant at the time, just been made up to sergeant, that was his fifth fighting tour.
Mm.
So there's people who were at the start of the Afghan conflict, who by the end of it, from the Royal Marine side of things, who'd done 8 tours.
Bloody hell. And you ended up doing 6 in total?
I ended up doing 6 operational deployments, yeah. Wow. So 4 to Afghan and then other stuff.
Mm.
So, yeah.
So when you came back after that one, how long were you back for before you were back out again?
So I come back. I basically taken a running jump with the rest of my section. I was leading the section as a point man under fire, trash my knee. So PCL, cartilage, put a big contusion over the shin bone, had to come back, have an operation. The moment I could bear weight, they wouldn't let me go back out on tour because like you say, match fit.
Yeah.
If you've got anything wrong with you,
yeah, I agree.
Even lads that are in the most impeccable condition, it doesn't matter. You could be as fast as a greyhound, as strong as a shire horse. Mm. I mean, my resting heart rate in Camp Bastion, when the nurses were putting some fluids back in me and all the rest of it, was 39 beats a minute.
There you are.
So I was absolutely peaking at 22 years of age.
Yeah.
But carrying 174 pounds of kit in 50 degree heat and being the bloke who kicks all the doors in, who runs across all the open ground, who takes all the sort of the sprog routine as it was at the time, you're the first man, the point man, or being the guy on the metal detector or driving a vehicle down a road that's not being metal detected.
Yeah.
Not being in the special forces meant that you're just on a monocle. Yep. You're not on the two-way or four-way gogs that you see people using. So you've just got this monocle, which gives you an element of night vision, but it doesn't give you depth.
Right.
You lose depth perception. Okay. It's really hard to navigate your way through, especially if you're going out at night in small teams into unknown enemy numbers and you haven't got the intelligence picture that you might have at that level where you're going after high value targets and people have been watching target for hours on end, and it's not like that.
Did you have someone who you looked up to?
Yeah, very much so. What? I would say I looked up to Bri Price, who was the section.
Okay. Section commander. And what did he have? He was obviously older than you. What did he have that you really liked that you said, I want to put that in my makeup?
There was an air of resilience about that man that I think I'd only just learned a little bit of his story, and it's not for me to tell his story, but I knew that he'd been in the army before, that he'd been to the rank of sergeant. I don't know what had happened in the middle, but I knew that he'd lost everything, come back, joined the corps, and was now corporal again and heading for sergeant. I think actions and deeds speak louder than words for me in my book. If someone is a man of honor and they do something, they physically, it's because seeing is believing, the old Stoic phrase, I'm inclined to trust that over what people say, especially now at 37 years of age and in the world of business, being a bit more savvy and having had my fingers burnt a few times, you've got to show me the metric.
Yeah, agree.
Don't just talk about it.
Yeah, agree.
So I watched him during that first initial ambush. We had to fix bayonets. We had danger close artillery, 105 artillery shells coming from 6K away, landing at less than 100 meters in front of us. I lost all my hearing in that ear for 2-3 days. Bri took a round through the C and out the O on his commando flash and just carried on the radio like he was buying a pint of milk, you know. And and he knew what he was doing because we were all laying flat initially when it started. And it's just a huge volume of fire. So the sort of things that are coming our way are, for anyone who's into this sort of thing, RPKs, the AK-47 itself, just on full auto, just emptying over a wall at you. So there's not even much to return fire at. Now, I was lucky. I had a mini-me. So it's a belt-fed gas-operated weapon. And I emptied a belt of 200 very quickly and had to do a change.
So just to get my head around this, you've got 200 bullets you're just firing out within how long?
I could be wrong, but I think something like 600 rounds a minute if you just held the...
Bloody hell.
If you just held it down.
But 600?
Not that it would do that.
Yeah.
But it's got a fast firing rate.
Right, okay.
And so even in bursts and controlled bursts across the top of the wall, which I was struggling to see because there's so much coral dye off of our weapon systems, so much...
Dust.
Dust.
Off the floor,
We've all oiled our weapons. Yeah. Even though we're told to run them dry, no one trusts that. Nobody wants a stoppage. Everyone just oils everything to death. They've done the same.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like, have you ever seen that scene in that old movie, Master and Commander, where the two ships pull up? And as soon as it all starts, nobody can see anything.
Yeah.
Everyone's just blindly firing.
Was that what it was like?
That's what it felt like.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was just.
Was that tour there your toughest tour?
I would say in terms of direct action in front of the enemy, that was my toughest tour because that was literally day to day, clearing rooms, grenades in, first guy in. Some of the stuff that happened there, like I'd get up onto a rooftop. I know you wouldn't put your head above the roof first. I'd put the metal detector up, metal detect myself a little space above, then put my head up a few times like this, then put my weapon up. No one's going to, you know, have a pop at me there. Okay, I'll have a look around. I just remember finding this big RPG, rocket propelled grenade, the pin taken out of it and a big dent in it. And it was just sat there. And I couldn't see any wires coming out of it. So anyway, I'm reporting down the ladder and they're like, yeah, right, everyone pull back. Goldie, pick it up, come down the ladder, place it on the floor. We're going to put some Dems next to it and we're going to blow it. So I'm like, at this point in the game, just so anyone's listening, yeah, they have like a crystal fuse. And once it's already been fired off as well, this thing is volatile.
Yeah.
And so even like you leaning over, your temperature change of you creating a shadow on this thing could make it go off.
Yeah.
So I've like had myself a little moment, picked the thing up, gone down the stairs. Courage is being terrified, but doing it anyway,
yep,
is what I've come to decide. Yep. So I put it down, I scuttle back, they put the Dems on it, kaboom. Turns out the whole building was rigged anyway, so that really went up.
Right.
That then started a massive firefight from behind us. So they'd been getting into position behind us with their red motorbikes and all the rest of it. And then I remember scrabbling up this, through a river and up a riverbank, and the guy in front of me having his antenna shot off. So the antenna, so the rounds were passing behind us as we're trying to get up into this next piece of cover, and just watching the antenna snap and it fell on the floor. I don't know why I zoned in on it out of everything else that was happening. I scooped it up and I stuffed it in my top and I took it back. And at the end, I went, at the end of that patrol, I went and gave it to that individual and I said, oh, you ditching kit. And I held it out and you could see where the round had just literally taken it off. And so he said, I'll give you a quarter of a bottle of whiskey for that. And at that time in my life, bearing in mind, I was going out patrol and I'd be happy to go meet my maker as long as I'd had a spam fritter and I was happy. I took the quarter of a bottle of whiskey and I went and drank it in the grots, with shared it with some of those faces.
Quality.
So yeah, it was a nice little moment.
Well, you just said they're the enemy. I'm trying to visualize what the enemy would look like. You mentioned like red motorbikes. What are they dressed in? What are they booting around in? How do you know they are the proper enemy? And can you take them out if you just...
No. So you've got, God, this is some time ago now, but you've got your card alpha. So you've got a set of rules that you must abide by. So you can only fire if you're being fired upon. There's a lot of hard and fast stuff you must stick to.
Hold on a minute. I'm going to roll that bit. You can only fire back if you're being fired upon.
I know, it's bonkers.
Wow.
And the more the tour went on and the more these tours went on, the more it felt like you were trying to do a job as a handcuffed crab.
Yeah.
Because we were also essentially playing world police.
Yeah.
So we'd have special kits that we'd get locals to come forward. We start to take their biometrics, their name, you know, a rough date of birth, height, facial features. We get them to do swabs looking for presence of explosives to see where they'd been handling bits and pieces. But quite commonly, having a decent watch on your wrist, trainers, not necessarily sandals. Very proud individual, fine facial hair, and maybe something like a big black dish dash, you know, big black turban type of arrangement on the head. Someone of status could possibly indicate.
Okay.
But you wouldn't know.
Okay.
You really don't know.
I'm not, I can't, it's an odd one, because you're out there and someone else's land.
Yeah.
They're thinking they hate you.
Yeah.
You're thinking, if they shoot at me first, I can shoot you back. There's got to be a point where a lot of soldiers are like, you know what? I've got those rules got to go out the window, because it's my life versus his life.
Mm. Yeah, quite quickly, the dehumanization process kicks in, but you must maintain the moral ground. You must maintain that moral ground. It would be all too easy to slip into that. And we've seen that in the past and we know it's gone on. It's been in the news many times. There's a massive hunt on at the moment. The Australian SF have been in trouble. There's a lot of that going on. To my mind, all I can say is that for me, sat here in this yellow chair in front of you now today, I did everything in my power, the right place at the right time with what I had in front of me.
Yeah.
And I can stand there with my hand on my heart and know that my conscience is clear. Everything I did back then as that character, as that version of me as a young man, in a place of war, I can stand by that because I was doing my job with the orders I was given at that time.
And if you're saying the rules are out there, who's to say that our guy shot first at them? Who's going to go back? Who's going to go back and say, yeah, Nick shot first. All right, you're going to go in army prison. Who's going to say that?
Well,
surely everyone looks after everyone going, mate, you did your best. Don't worry about that. You did your best. What? Surely, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's not like you're right. It's not like, you know, it's not Premiership football. We can't wind it back.
Mm.
We can't look at the video replay again and again and again. Effectively, you've got about the same amount of time a professional cricketer has to choose what shot to make as that ball's hurtling down there to decide whether to pull the trigger or not as you're walking around doorways and you see a flash of dish dash, a person, was it a stick? Was it a rifle? What was it? I'll give you a breakdown of a typical day on patrol.
Yeah.
You'll do an 18-hour patrol in that heat.
This is you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. On about 3 litres of water.
Yeah.
And then you'll get back, you'll clean your weapon meticulously, you'll make sure the batteries are topped up, the vehicles are good to go, the electronic countermeasures are up and running. You're looking at probably 2 hours faffing. Then you'll try and get your head down for 2 hours. Then someone will wake you up to go get the terp awake and get everyone ready and blah, blah, blah. And you might do a couple of hours on a sentry. That might also happen in that last 2 hours. Then you're back out on 18 hours patrol again.
Yeah.
At no point is your young, even though it's agile, but young mind able to fully go through the sleep cycle, and the rapid eye movement and the processes you should be getting.
Yeah.
It's not there.
Mm.
It's simply not there. So day after day, you go out the door and you see all kinds of messed up stuff. Because you're coming from a point of HMS, Great Britain, the NHS bubble.
Yeah.
You've grown up a certain way. If you knock your teeth out on the skateboard park, it's all right. You can have new teeth by the end of the week.
Yeah.
That's kind of our world, yeah? Mm. They're living in a world where if you get bitten by a dog, that's rabies or death.
Yeah.
And everything is inshallah. And so everything is very kind of, nothing's hard and fast. The rules are very fluid according to whichever warlord is in power at the time. And then, of course, you have the religious laws that you must abide to as well. And so to us, we look at it and go, wow, this is really, you know, what this is so alien in terms of culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
But actually, to them, it makes total sense. And so you're a young man, you've gone out there, you know, you're full of piss and vinegar. You want to prove yourself. You're there with, you know, 4 or 5 commando, blah, blah, blah. It's all good. And you're chomping at the bit to get stuck in because you've just been conditioned. So your conditioning your culture for the last 6 to 8 months has been gearing up for this scrap. And it never ends. That's why that, going back to that training, that dislocation of expectation, you get back in off patrol. Oh, something else is going off.
Yeah.
You're jumping in a wagon. You're now the quick reaction force, the QRF. You're bouncing straight out again. So you might end up actually doing 2-3 days without sleep.
Yeah.
In the middle of it, though, when you're back in this, I describe this location, this forward operating base, you're getting rocketed.
Mm.
So it's not like you're getting any downtime.
Yeah.
There's rockets coming in.
Yeah.
I remember I was there trying to do a bit of a workout one day and all I had was a load of iron pickets all welded together, like 6 iron pickets. But it gave me something, right?
Yeah.
And just this straight over the top and boom. I was like, right, ditch that, run back into the building. Everyone went running in. And yeah, it was some recoilless rifle. It's called a Wombat. It's a great big Russian-made recoilless rifle. They just fired that at us and it just gone straight over the top.
Mm.
There's only so many times you get lucky.
Yeah.
And it becomes a game of percentages. And if you look at the stats from that time, you were 11 times more likely to become a casualty serving in that particular part of the world at that time. And there were like 700 of us to hold something the size of Yorkshire, just to try to paint this picture and contextualize to the viewer. So yeah, it was a hectic time.
You mentioned the word warlord.
Yeah.
Tell me what you were actually looking for out there. You said you're going bashing in doors.
So drugs.
Yeah.
So a lot of drugs coming out of Afghanistan. Heroin. Obviously poppies are rife out there. So there'll be drug production going on. And then it would then be harvested and it'd be taken to labs, pushed out on mule across mountains. And then later in my career, when I was working alongside other gentlemen, some of which you were talking to recently, Staz and the gang, they'd be going and taking out high value targets and taking out labs, which were often placed in the bottom of these tiny steep ravines. So, you know, it's very inviting for you to go down there and then all hell would break loose. Yeah. And then they'd place some DEMs on there and blow those up before they get to market or they get sent out. But it was tricky because at the same time, there is evidence to suggest, you can go find that on the internet, that warlords who were doing rather well at this were then paying in other foreign fighters from other countries who were then coming in and taking up the fight, keeping us busy. so they could carry on with their operations. So it really was. And I think at the time there were 2,500 Britons fighting out there as well for the other side.
For the other side?
Yeah. Yeah, taking up a jihad. Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was just, I look at my younger self and I'm sort of like, I'm still that guy, but yeah. But it's that was a version of me at that point in my life.
Older, wiser.
Yeah, certainly now.
For
yeah.
what you know now, for everything you've been through,
yeah,
would you go back and do the same thing?
That's a really, really good question. I think we could all ask ourselves that to a degree, but you and I wouldn't be who we are now.
Agree.
If we hadn't have done all the things we did, the good, the bad, and I'm not going to use the word ugly, the human, the good, the bad, and the human, because we all have needs, wants, desires. Yeah. We all act and play up in a certain way because our chimp wants a banana. Yeah. If you don't find a way to give your chimp a banana, it will go take a banana. Yeah. That's how life works. Yeah. So when you think about that, I needed to be that character. Yeah. I needed to be quite an extreme, high speed, high performance individual. And I thrived in the feeling of being part of that. Yeah. I felt that inclusion, yeah. and I felt that brotherhood to a point. Mm. But then something weird happened. At the end of the tour, we all just went our different ways.
Yeah.
And everybody had this nasty taste in our mouths from it all.
Is that when you retired?
No.
Or was that just after that first tour?
No, that's when I should have retired.
Yeah, okay.
But I didn't know when enough was enough, did I? So,
yeah.
So we all came back from the tour. The lads had finished the other half of the tour, came back, and I got to see them because I didn't have comms with them, etc. But I guess they didn't know what I'd been up to. So the moment I was able to bear weight on my leg, I was coffin bearing. So every person coming back from our group in a coffin, I was then carrying their coffin.
Oh, mate.
So whoever in the Good Ideas Club decided that we'll take lads from Hardened Troop, the injured guys, if they're able to, we'll ask them, and you're never going to say no, are you? It's the greatest honor to be able to put your brother in the ground. So you then had to do Lineham for the repatriation, which is when basically the Union Jack draped coffin comes off the back of the bird in total silence, apart from the sound of the clicking up in the tower, which is the Sun newspaper or whatever, just you could hear it. That's the only thing you could hear on that parade square. And then basically the awkward process where you're there with your white gloves on, your blues, all the rest of it, just trying to be sort of mega non-emotional. And you're placing that coffin into the hearse vehicle. And that's the first time it really hits the family. And I distinctly remember time after time, mothers, aunties, particularly female voices, crying, breaking down. And then you have to do it all again on the day of the race, where you actually go to the church of said person's life. And then you place them in the ground. And of course, they're all very individual stories. They're all etched into your memory. It's very hard to not feel, you know, have empathy for the families. And you'd have little micro instances where I think at one of the funerals, one of the mums sort of grabbed me by the lapel, turned me round really quickly because I looked like the chap.
Yeah.
I'm not going to name any names.
Yeah.
For a second, she thought that I was hit. So one spouse was literally burying her husband, who they'd been married 7 weeks to the day in the same church he's now being buried in.
Oh, mate.
And so, you know, one of the holes was hand dug and he's such a big lad. There had to be some last minute to widen the hole to get it ready for, I can still see that exactly on the left-hand side of the path on the way up to the church. Mm. So these are all things that stay with you, these experiences, you know, they're character, they're part of you and you are part of it. But that's what makes this time of year so hard for us as veterans, for me as a person, because I feel I don't know where I'm supposed to be. I don't know whose grave I'm supposed to be next to or where I'm supposed to sit, stand, whatever I'm supposed to do myself. So I've been managing myself very closely the last 2 weeks in particular as I'm on this roller coaster. Yeah. And then you add into the old classic fireworks night, you know, and if you've been amongst it up close and personal, then fireworks is not an ideal thing. And there's actually a movement that's just been started. I think it's called The Sound of Fireworks.
Yeah.
And it's deliberately for Armed Forces veterans. And all it is just like an online roster to say, you sign up to it. And then if you're having a fireworks party, the idea is that everyone can see in your local area, there's going to be a massive fireworks party. Yeah. You can kind of preempt it to a degree.
Yeah.
If not for the sake of us, and sake of the pets.
Yeah, it's the dog.
This is a massive thing. Yeah. So me and Tilly are on the sofa like my little Labrador.
How many brothers funerals have you been to?
I did 14 funerals in 6 months. So 14 times I attended a service in 6 months. So some of that was funerals. Some of that I was in the role of firing party. And one was a civilian one right at the end, which he was our town mayor. He was a lovely man. I was on leave. I had the time and he was a sort of a friend of the family. So I was like, I'll go. Boy, did I realize suddenly there and then in that moment, I can't ever go to another funeral again.
Why is that?
I can't. Don't think I can do it again.
Okay.
And the biggest thing for me is the last post.
Yeah.
Because you're standing there just non-emotional. Everyone's looking at you. You've just like been lowering on this like almost like a rope, lowering, and you just have to hold yourself the whole way through. I remember getting to I had a fight with a lad. It's really uncharacteristic for me. So I had a fight with a lad in Exmouth on a night out after one of these things, and it was actually something that brought us closer together than I ever thought. It was weird because up until that point, it was a bit of a thing because I'm a Southern lad. I'm probably the most Southern man at the unit. Mm. You know, Arbroath, Scotland is 4-5 commando, so it's full of Geordies and Scousers and Manx. And I think I was a bit of an unknown quantity at the time. And we were all feeling it. We were all, you know, internalizing this thing. So, yeah, we're in this bar and it all kicked off and I broke my watch. It's a really nice watch. And it was something simple as just utterly bollocks at the end of the night, just knocked into each other and what's your problem? Blah, blah, blah. Whoosh, off it went. And we all got thrown out. And I seem to remember the icebreaker at the end, as it was all quite serious. And it was like, you know, we got problems in house here and what's going on. And was one of the lads basically dropped his kecks and turned one out on the doorstep of the club as we were being thrown out. And it just broke. Honestly,
I shouldn't laugh, but that is,
at that point in the game, I don't think any of us realized how bad our mental health
was. Yeah, that's what I'm about to say. Yeah.
Because our levels of norm coming off the battlefield, dehumanized, and bearing in mind, there is no, at this point, the decompression process wasn't there. Not that it works anyway.
Was that when you fly back into Cyprus?
Two cans of beer and a night in Cyprus with a comedian and then you're okay. Right, having been running around with a bayonet on for 6 months. I'd definitely not okay. So that broke the ice. And then I was invited out to every piss up after that. And it was, I'd gone from being the sprog to being, I'd sort of shown myself to what happens when you push the buttons basically.
Have you ever been nicked before?
Many times unofficially. So I was very, very lucky. And if he's listening to this, thank you, Phil. A former paratrooper, used to live over the road, he was either a cop or a special. I don't know how it used to work. But every time I came back home, I'd had this pattern of behavior where I'd pull the pin. And it would almost always end up with me, Rowdy, Larry, in the street, outside with a kebab in my hand at the end of the night.
Yeah.
And pull up. And I'd be put in the car, taken home, given the old story about here we are again, going around the learning tree. Yeah. I think it was from him I got the phrase, the learning tree.
Yeah.
Dropped off at my parents' house. Just wake up in the morning, vague memory or not remembering how I got home. And he basically used to save my bacon time and time and time and time again. So a very courteous and polite man. Other than that, no. No.
Going back to the question I asked before, for what you know now, would you have done what you've done?
I think I'd need to, because now I have a rather wide experiential range, which I'm able to apply readily to people when I'm working with them in the here and now in my new life. I call it my new life. That was the past life. This is the new life.
Do you think these tours that you're out there, do you think they were a success?
I think for us as a body of men in our various ages now, dads and all the rest of it, as we look back, I think that we were a success as a unit at what we did. And when you actually look at what we were trying to take on and what we overcame and the way that we soldiered, exemplary. Now, on behalf of HM Forces, you know, we our battle group alone, when we got out there, pushed the flat 3 kilometres in every direction. You know, so from us arriving on the ground, from whatever good work that the paratroop regiment had done before the Irish Rangers, we then pushed out the enemy another 3 kilometres in every direction, but just through that sheer pace.
But by doing that, when you lot left, everyone left, what happened when you all left?
Well, ultimately, it's all back in the hands of wherever we started.
So that's my point. My point is, was it worthwhile?
I think so. As young warriors, I'm getting a bit stoic now, but I think I was probably always going to be someone who's more predisposed to want to, because in your mind, you're defending the White Cliffs of Dover,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When you look at those who've gone before, you look at the sort of World War II veterans, the Falklands, literally retaking British sovereignty. Yeah. And I think that it's very easy for a generation such as mine and the Iraq generation to feel like this is totally pointless. What was it all for? What a waste of life. Something I've really worked hard on is revisiting those ugly parts, human parts of me, asking myself the deeper meaningfuls in the right environment around that campfire and with other people, gone through this and gone, look, if you can look back at that situation and really search yourself, how does that feel? Because that's the important thing.
Yeah.
You've got to realize that feeling is driven by a meaning that you made. Now, the meaning I made about the world at 22 years of age was that I'm doing the right thing. I'm trying to. So, but that's not always the case. When you go back and look at other things you made a meaning around, you think, oh God, why was I thinking that way? I can now see it's this. But you've also got to stand true to yourself and know that in that moment, at that time, that was the best thing you could have done with the information you had in front of you. The 37-year-old version of yourself that I am today didn't exist. He wasn't there.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't have gone through all that stuff, he wouldn't have this mindset in the first place. So I'd still be...
As an adult now at 37, if they gave you a call up with the situation you're in now, would you go back to war?
I've had so many memes and GIFs sent to me about this recently. I think in my subconscious, in the 97% of me that's offline, there is a deep belief that I'm probably going to end up getting involved again somehow. Not that I want to for a second. Just because of the way the geopolitical climate seems to be playing out. There's a lot of things going on in this world.
Yeah.
Whether it's in a training role, because I'll be dad's army by then, or whether it's, right, like the sort of thing that's going on at the moment in other parts of the world, that's another matter. But I'm definitely not going to let myself slip. So I'm not, you know, training as I used to when I was that young 22-year version of myself, but I'm certainly not letting myself slip either. And I probably imagine most of the boys and girls listening who were in around that time period, depending on their level of physical injury, their physical limitations and mental limitations, are probably keeping themselves in as good condition as they possibly can do. That's not to say that I'm a ninja zombie apocalyptic survival fantasist and I believe that and I want this to happen. I certainly do not.
We mentioned earlier about PTSD. There's different levels of PTSD. There's a lower level and there's a super high level.
Yeah.
When you come out, did you have PTSD?
Oh, I was in a bad way. I was in a bad way.
When you say
way.
A bad way, what's a bad way?
I had blue tack over the camera and speaker on the phone. The battery would be taped to the outside of the phone. I'd come off the back of a 7-year period of my life, which was, if I hadn't have written about something, some of it already, you couldn't write it. So it was literally like that first tour, come back, carrying coffins, start drinking, get into a bit of trouble, becomes a pattern of behavior, which is being driven by feelings, meanings of which I don't even understand. Yeah. That then turns into, meeting need to get away from 4-5. Need to get away from 4-5. What else is out there for me in this job role in the Corps? Well, actually, the world of special forces does entertain me, but I don't think I'm ready. Do I want to go on selection? I don't think really in my heart of heart I want to put myself on selection. Okay, cool. So I've got to pick a role inside of the Corps because you get so many months as a gravel belly, as someone who's out there doing it. And then you have to pick a specialization.
Yeah.
Because as a standalone force, as commandos, we have lots of things that happen inside. So we have our own mechanics, our own chefs, signalers, clerks, drivers. You're a commando first and foremost. You jump in on the patrol matrix and then you have a secondary role.
Yeah.
The idea is you can drop us all off on top of a mountaintop. Everyone can shake out and do what they need to do. Cool. So I took the only course that no one else wanted, and having a French mother and a Parisian, a family based in Paris, all of which are chocolatiers or patisseries, I was like, do you know what? I quite fancy this chef malarkey. It got sold to me a little bit as, well, you go do this, and because you've got a tour under your belt, yada yada, we'll make you up to corporal within 2 years. A filthy lie.
Mm.
But I was like, okay, cool, I'll go for it. But I'll do it under one condition. So I tried to be cheeky and negotiate. I'll do it if I get to go to pool, sir. So he was like, actually, I've got two PIDs.
Pool, downhill pool.
Yeah, well, so I've got two PIDs to go and work alongside the boat service.
Yeah.
You can get in on the branch there.
Yeah.
Only if you're successful in completing this course. And the big joke is no one's ever completed the course. Mm. Little did I know that Sodexo actually do all of the stuff on the base. So whoever it is now, I don't know. But at the time, it was Sodexo. So I was unlikely to actually do anything on the base in that respect. But anyway, I passed the course, went down there, been there about a week. And my experiences of the military at that point is very sort of rigid. Yes, sir. No, sir. Free bags full, sir. So I saluted someone, got pulled to one side, had a word with, we don't do that here, got shouted at, you know. So, okay, cool. So that was my learning curve.
Yeah.
I managed to wedge a lorry under the road bridge, you know which one, down by the Yachtsmith.
Yeah.
In my first week. What else did I do? And then I got pinged, probably as a result of the lorry incident, following a car sat nav and I remember edging under it going, is this going to fit, Crunch? I then got pinged out to go out to the jungle with one of the squadrons.
So you got pinged out to go to the jungle with the SBS?
Yeah.
Special forces.
So that's where I was going to get.
Yeah.
Anything I was doing at that point would be with one of the squadrons from that unit.
Yeah.
So at the time, there was a team leader who some of you will know, Mr. Jason Fox.
Yeah.
And they were going to, and the idea, and this is
He's a great lad, Foxy.
Hell of a bloke. Yeah. So this is a bit of an old hat story now because it's well known. So there was a new piece of equipment coming in and it was a type of boat. It's called an Ork. And it was being sort of riverine tested. It had been tested in Norway, been tested in open sea. How would it stand up to being thrown about in riverines? It was all very good and well until you actually stack the thing full of body armor plates. You put all the ammunition, all the lads on it, and then it basically just turns into a bus. So, but nevertheless, you know, that's what the MOD had. So I guess it was Paul looking at whether they wanted this piece of a kit and a load of other stuff going on at the same time. So it's my first trip with them. And all I've known up until that point is that your troop sergeant's like your mum. He's like, have you had your jabs? Have you done this? Are you up to date with this? You need to do this training. I got to Paul as an individual augmentee, as it's known. So you're like, and you're attached to whatever squadron's going wherever. And a learning curve is like this.
Yeah.
But I'm forever thankful now in the world of business because, and this is the new meaning made by the new 37-year-old version of myself, is that it's allowed me, or it allowed me at the time, to become entrepreneurially minded. I had to learn to exploit gray space and learn how to work the angles and learn how to maneuver myself and look after myself and have this little roll-top canoe bag in my pocket with my passport, my yellow fever, all my different bits and pieces. Because at the drop of a hat, you'd be off out the door.
Yeah.
Sometimes within 20 minutes, notice. To wherever, could be a fancy pants nuclear exercise scenario based thing that goes all around the country. It could be anything. So I really thrived because you were also a needed member of the team. And so I was starting to find that identity very quickly. That's not to say for a second that I was necessarily accepted by those who'd passed selection because there was a bit of us and them. And then
did they look down at you?
Or
did you look up at them?
I'd say I definitely looked up at them.
Yeah.
The majority of the old guard who were in there at the time were mega humble, brilliant, humble blokes who were just phenomenal at their craft and know their job inside out.
That's nice to hear.
And they're career men. Mm. You'll have probably heard other people saying that, you know, there definitely was a noted stage during the 4 and a bit years where I was down there where there was a bit of an influx of new faces who'd come from commando units who I maybe had served with around that time. And there was a little bit of element of the what we call the pop stars' egos. Yeah. But they're quite quickly tempered by that old guard. And you need a mix of new blood and old blood. It's important.
Yeah.
It's important.
Are there any that stand out that had that sort of ego?
Probably, but I'm not going to name anyone.
No. I'm just saying, but you were there thinking, right, I've clocked you. You've got a massive ego in you. Could you tell straight away, what was the vibe that was given off?
I don't know, because you've also got to remember that these guys have just passed an incredibly difficult course to be to where they are.
Oh, the creme de la creme world.
The accolade for like 4 blokes to be left at the end of it.
Yeah.
So quite rightly so, they're probably just leaning into that role, you know, and learning about themselves and you as a support rank when no one else is looking.
Yeah. How would you sum up your career in the Royal Marines?
Eclectic and diverse. Yeah, I certainly didn't do the same job role for any amount of time, moved around a lot, got to do a lot of very interesting stuff that many of my peers never got a look in at. Mm. I'm proud of it, looking back now. And again, we are but the sum of our experience. You take all the weird and wonderful stuff you did before, the good, the bad, the human, you put it all together and you get to be the product you are today. So from battlefield into the world of bushcraft and now into business as I'm kind of doing this, you know, business leadership development stuff, as I'm becoming a speaker, as I'm an author and consultant, things are kind of evolving. Yeah. You take all of that with you.
Yeah.
It's yours to own for a start. But at this point, I've done my time in the Corps, lots of weird and wonderful, exciting stuff. Then I find myself in a Naval Recovery Service Centre in a bad way after tour number 6. Got diagnosed complex post-traumatic stress disorder, suffering terribly, to be honest. And if I hadn't had the maturity or the option to reach out and make that phone call to the psych nurse, because there'd been a bureaucratic error at the end of the tour, I'd been diagnosed. That's it for you. I'd come
diagnosed with PTSD.
Complex post-traumatic stress.
And this was on your 6th tour. Where were you?
So I was in Afghan.
Yeah.
I was directly attached to 2 squadrons at Poole who'd ripped through. I'd done 7 months with no R&R. I wasn't being looked after by my hierarchy at the time. It was at the end of that 7-year roller coaster. So tour number 1 was what it was. Tour number 2... go back out the door, and this is my first tour with Paul I'm attached to. Yep. Tour number 3, same sort of sketch. Yep. Over Christmas, that one. Between tours number 1 and 2, I'd saved the life of a young lady in a pub toilet at a lock-in. Arguably, I wouldn't have been at the lock-in if I wasn't drinking. So right place, wrong time, wrong place, right time, however you want to word it. But she'd severed a femoral artery on a broken mirror, just pulling her knickers up in a toilet, knocked into a mirror, came off the wall mount. I had the subsequent med training and call to action about me to do what I had to do. So I stemmed the bleed, shielded her from it, literally was standing on her chest. She went into hypervolemic shock. She lost half the blood in her body, up me, up the ceiling, up the wall. It was a very visceral, traumatic event. Led to more drinking between tours. So basically, my sort of character was very high speed, low drag. I was either on the lash and being loose, or being on a treadmill. So I'd come in out of a place called the Camel Bar in Bournemouth, Poole area.
Yeah, that goes until 6 in the morning, apparently.
Get in at 6, get straight on a treadmill, bang out 8 miles.
Oh, really? You're one of them?
Chip paste. Yeah. So I'd then punish myself.
Yeah, okay.
And I was doing this.
Okay.
Which is not a long game plan if you want to last very long.
Yeah.
Anyway, so tour number 2, tour number 3. At this point in the game, it becomes apparent that my native fluent French speaking comes of use. I get Willy Wonka's golden ticket. And from the other side of things, not from the support side or the regular squadron side of things, the big hand comes down and I get fast forwarded into a whole new world where the learning curve is like this. and it's very unconventional soldering, is I think is where I'll lead that. And if you want to put some wording to it without unpacking it all, working in direct support of wider UK government objectives. So I was finding myself with one other, perhaps, business class, flying into parts of the world for prolonged periods of time, doing stuff, then coming back out. But all the while, not officially recognised in any way, shape or form, and working alongside my regular day-to-day lads, that then causes friction.
Yeah.
Because then it's, oh, fuck me, here he is, James Bond, where have you been? Yeah. And it's, I'm not saying anything and I still won't today. Yeah. So that's kind of how that works. And it's murky. Mm. It's a very murky world. And so to move on from that subject, I did a couple of jobs like that and then was still-
Were you wearing civvy clothes doing these jobs?
Yes, very much so, yeah.
Very much so, okay. Yeah. What sort of countries are you talking?
Africa as a continent as a whole. Amongst other French-speaking places. Yeah, so that was basically that part of my life. And then obviously all of that is very compartmentalized. So my wife, to this day, I don't share bits of that. And she, bless her, was calling up at one point. I disappeared on an exchange exercise with the French Special Forces counterpart, Commando Hubert, down in Toulon. And so to her knowledge, I was still down there, but I disappeared weeks ago from there, somewhere else.
Ivory Coast?
Africa, mate. Just it's a big place,
isn't it? I'm just thinking French speaking.
Yeah, I mean, stuff. They pretty speak French right the way up across to the north. Right the way down to the bottom. Yeah, all over. So, which is why years later, I was given the opportunity to do some humanitarian work and to kind of make my peace with Africa. I went back, which is a brave thing for me to do, personally speaking. And I went back to an area just south of Johannesburg. So South Africa, really, but it's known as Lesotho. So it's separate.
What were you making your peace about?
So I'd kind of spoken about the fact that I felt that Afghanistan still had rules. You abide by the religion. You play the game by the culture you live in. Nothing bad should technically happen to you. You steal, you have your hand cut off, so on and so forth. Africa was raw.
Yeah.
When it's the lion's time to eat, he'll eat. So coup d'etat every 2 minutes, like just overthrow. Chaotic.
Coup d'etat, did you say?
Yeah. So when you overthrow the government, so you go in, you take out the entire, whoever's in power, shoot up the television station, say we're in power now. 2 weeks later, it's happening again. Everyone's dead again. Just keeps happening.
Oh, wow.
Chaotic stuff, really. Wild, wild and chaotic. And a world away from my life now. So there was a bit of that. Started to cause friction because I was then kind of considered what a weird fish. Mm. So I wasn't sort of swimming in the same streams as Stas and Louis. But I equally now suddenly wasn't swimming in the same streams as the Marine Commandos. Okay. I was kind of there in the support role with. That was very hard. Very confusing time for me. And when you're being different versions of yourself and you have all that stuff going on, you can end up quite fractured as a person.
I'm sure. There's nothing worse. You're coming back and the boys are like, what have you been up to? Not much. Where have you been?
Been away doing...
That's going to cause a massive problem.
Why did
they pick you? Why did they pick you to go and do these things in Africa?
I think that's a question I've asked myself and I've torn myself apart many times over the campfire because I don't actually have an answer for it. But when I piece together the evidence, parking the emotional side of my brain and just using the critical thinking, no tattoos, distinguishing marks or features, fluent native French speaking, right place, right time. There should have been another character who probably would have been fitted for that role, but he'd just been shot through the shoulder on the tour before. And I was on that when that happened, when they came back into a location. So I saw that character and I knew that he was injured. Maybe he'd put in a good word. I don't know. I had lots of conversations offline with lots of people of every rank. I guess that's the beauty of sometimes being behind the hot plate on the exercise. Mm. You know, you're stood there, you've got all this food out in front of you.
Yeah.
You chit chat, lads come in, they sit down and you have a coffee and whatever. And I've kind of honed that soft skill set and then taken that. And then again, that's a key part of what I do now.
Yeah.
So it's about the soft skills. It's not necessarily about being noisy,
yeah.
going noisy at the first sign of trouble, and you have to literally
think
yeah. under massive duress.
Yeah.
You've only got to look through the newspapers to see what happens to people when it goes wrong.
Mm. Has there ever been a time in your life where you thought you were about to die?
Yeah, loads. That first ambush.
The first one, when you first landed.
8th of October 2008, 4:45 in the afternoon, and my world stopped.
Right.
couldn't hear out this ear for 3 days. Yeah. You know, I definitely thought at that point, this is it.
Okay.
And we got hit. I mean, I say that ambush. We got hit. We had 3 ambushes that day on the way back.
Yeah.
And when we got back, we were diffy a piece of equipment. A metal detector had been left submerged in a stream bed. So they turned us all around, and we were going to head back down the same path we'd all just been shot at coming up, and Muggins was going to lead the company out. So I got about 50 feet out the door, and I remember this feeling of disappointment, just this utter sadness and disappointment in me that this was going to be my lot. This was it. This is what it's all come to. All the training, all the work, all the years of rugby, that, you know, the becoming the epitome of the physical creature that yeah. I was, and I'm going to get slotted because I'll be the first guy coming out yeah. the gate. So sad for myself. And then just heard it on the radio. We got recalled.
I bet you're like, result, get me home.
I remember sitting there and then having this massive adrenal washing yeah. machine effect come down, which is why they get you cleaning all your weapons. That kind of busy hands for a quiet mind model, yeah. which again, I now teach around a campfire,
yeah.
is essential when you're in that washing machine adrenal fatigue cycle. Because you need to breeze through that and then be ready to good to go again, like 20 minutes later.
After your 6th tour, you said you got a huge amount of PTSD.
Yeah.
What actually is PTSD? What actually is the feeling of you waking up in the morning?
So for me, with the diagnosis of complex PTSD.
So we're saying like tier 1 PTSD here, like the most you can have.
It means there's lots of layers to it. It's not anchored in one single okay. point. And that's because between tour number 5 and tour number 6, my mum got cancer.
Mm.
So then, no. At this point, I've gone through this like short, sharp, hard career of all these stuff happening, all of which are like pretty life-changing events. No one's ever stopped and said, are you okay
yeah.
at this point? I've not seen a padre, nothing. Yeah. I'm then sat there watching my primary caregiver losing all her hair, proud Parisian woman, crying, saying, I can't do this anymore. I was on exercise in Cyprus and I remember speaking up in my hierarchy, let's say, not listening. They were like, no, we need you at Cyprus. So they sent me out there. I rang mum one night, don't know what made me do it, and she was rock bottom.
Yeah.
Hearing your mum like that is bad. So anyway, I turned to the sergeant major, whoever it was. At this point, you know, no fucks left in the pot. Everything's yeah. going out the window. So I'm like, right, get me home now. Couldn't have been more serious. Mm. I straight-eyed the guy and said, get me home now. He got me a J-hook, got me a plane. I was back something like 8 to 12 hours later in my mum's house.
Good.
And I remember I just got back. I just felt like I was on, you know, when you're really tired and you're not sure which way's up. I sort of got into my old bedroom, into my bed, and the door burst in and she came in crying and she was just in a right state, really bad.
Mm.
So I would then sit with her through her chemo. Because my mum and my dad and my sister had to go to work. So we went through this whole process together and she had to have invasive surgery, full radio, full chemo. She's pulled through.
Mm.
But anyone who's listening to this, who's had cancer in the family, been through it, been around it, touch wood, not lost anyone, but it does happen, will know that even those who are successful in their therapy can begin to live between scans.
Mm.
So you get the all clear, you're okay. Then life gets really hard again. Yeah. There's this kind of like pressure point building yeah. until the next scan. Then we're yeah. okay again. So even in the world of remission still looks like that. And it's very, very hard to navigate. And I'd say we're a close family, you know.
Mm.
So what I've done the yards on years later and discovered, I don't think I've ever shared this. When I was, so I was seeing this fantastic guy, Jonah, at 360 Rehab in Exmouth Marina. He's been helping me a lot with the neurology side and I've made massive progress there alongside talking therapies like EMDR, CBT, NLP, all that stuff. Mm. I've thrown everything in the kitchen sink at myself to get the level of function I have today and to be able to do what I do. And I'm talking, and he says to me, and I still to this day don't know how the guy does it. He works with Premiership football, all kind of people. He's a very clever man. He says, "What happened to between you and your dad when you was 4 or 5? And I was like, "I don't know what happened to me and my dad when I was 4 or 5. He goes, "Something poignant in your timeline." I had to go ask my parents. This is only a couple of years ago. So I'm sat my parents down. They were over at ours having dinner. "Mum, Dad, what happened that was poignant in my timeline?" And my mum clocked it and she went, "Oh, yes, when your sister was born. When Leticia was born, I was very ill. I was whisked off in the middle of the night, bleeding, septicemia problems. You woke up in the morning, where's mummy?" My whole world had been turned upside down. I thought I was going to lose my primary caregiver. Now you draw the comparison and line to when I finally had had my fill and started to like malfunction in my career. I came back from that and they banged me straight out to Afghan. They said, "Right, are you clear now?" I said, "Well, mum's in, technically she's in remission." I said, "Fine, you're off to Afghan, 7-month tour." During that 7-month tour is where the straw broke the camel's back. And I wonder, I don't know, but I wonder in my timeline whether a little door opened to a 4 or 5 year old me who thought the mummy was going to die. And I think it's possible.
Absolutely.
I think it's possible.
100%.
So at that point, bucket is now full. Coupled with on that tour, a lovely, lovely bloke lost his life and a couple of other lads got blown up quite badly and a load of stuff went wrong. Well, it didn't go wrong. It's just no best laid plan ever survives first contact with the enemy. It's a well-known expression. And so the sight nurse comes out. And at this point, I've got a massive handlebar moustache. My hair's out here. I don't recognise rank anymore. I'm very much under my own steam and I'm standing my own and I'm starting to have fallouts with everyone because I just won't be spoken to in a certain way. I'm not having it. I started to literally... I wasn't playing the game. I basically was not playing the game anymore. It's great so long as you believe in the game, right? It's a bit like fiat currency. I believe in fiat currency. You do, so I pay you. You promise to pay. And it all works. The moment you don't, it all falls over.
Yeah, you're out.
So that's where I found myself. So I pushed out the end of that tour, but I was having panic attacks. I was hearing and feeling explosions from 2008 from being on rooftops that weren't happening. At one point, I threw myself out of bed, put the general purpose machine gun on, picked up 2000 link, everything, all the kit, to go make my final stand in this little location we were at. And the two lads in my room jumped on me and were like, "Where are you going, crazy man?" And I had genuinely heard and felt the main gate go up. That was it. No. They made me, I put my helmet on and I stood out there in the dark with a pistol looking at this starry, empty sky, most beautiful sky ever.
So after that tour, what was it like coming back into civilian life going, "You know what, I'm done"?
So this is where the transition takes place. So I come back and the psych nurse says, "You've got to come see me when you come back, hand your weapons in." She asked me 3 questions, don't know what they were. And I fell apart. I fell apart and she went, "Right, you're going on leave." Looked it up. Oh yeah, you're owed. You're 101 days over the allowance that you're supposed to be out of the country in a certain rolling period. Because I'd been out of the country like 9 months of the year. I've been, it's hard to keep tabs because you don't belong to any one squadron. You just play human pinball. I'd spend 7 weeks in down near Yemen. Then I'd spend 9 weeks in the jungle. Then I'd go back down to that location. Then I'd be in Norway for however many weeks. And then I'd go out to Afghan for 4 or 5 months. Then I'd go back and I'd be back for a week here, a week there.
And did you have a missus at the time?
Yeah, Louise was very patient, but she was a busy CID police detective in Somerset and Avon.
Is that right?
Yeah. So we were like,
that's a combo for you, isn't it?
Well, and this is it. So little Finley, who's 4 years old now, what he knows about the world is that mummy was a police person and daddy was a police person for the world. World police. Team America.
Let's roll in on where you are today. What are you up to today? What's your world look like today?
Well, post all that went on after, I'll just skip through it so that we're on a timeline.
Yeah.
8 months, case conference was had. It was agreed that I was supposed to go from that tier one unit to the recovery center. Paperwork fuck up. So I end up at home on leave for 8 months in my lowest point. I then reach out to the one person I thought I could trust, which is the site nurse, pretty much on flip of a coin at this point of the game.
Flipping the coin for what?
For like not being here. So
you not being here?
Yeah, I was in a bad way.
What, you taking your own life?
I think it was a daily consideration at that point. And obviously I'm aware that little Finney's going to hear this when he grows up. So I think we need to understand the severity of the situation, but I don't like to talk about that particular word and go there with that stuff. Mm. I just wasn't, it's not that I wanted to, it's just I didn't want to be here.
So if you didn't want to be here, what things were going through your mind?
Well, I was pretty much drinking about a litre of a rum and just blacking out next to the campfire. The only place that felt right to me was being by the campfire.
Yeah, your safety net.
In that little piece of woodland that I'd bought in 2012 for a throwaway $6,000 that no one wanted type thing, that's now a globally recognised business. Yeah. It's mad, isn't it?
It's amazing. Amazing story.
Yeah, how it's turned around. Mm. So
Finley's 4 years old today, is he?
He's 4 in April. Well,
and how long have you been with your missus for?
A long time now. I must have been 24. Most of the arse end of my Marine career.
Yeah, okay.
So the first
What's
couple
name?
Years.
What's your wife's name?
Louise.
Louise. Big shout out to Louise.
Yeah, she's...
sticking by you.
Oh my God, she has... That woman has put up with a lot.
Yeah.
She's put up with a lot.
I'm sure.
And... You know, we laugh and joke now because we say it's about her now.
Mm.
She's had to park all of her stuff because can you imagine being a CID police officer?
Is she still a copper now?
Fraud, child protection squad. She's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Is she still a copper today?
No, she's out now.
Okay.
So she's got commendations and all sorts. She left at around the 11-year mark.
Yeah.
My time at the recovery centre came to an end around the 11-year mark.
Yeah. Perfect.
So we entered the world of what became Hidden Valley Bushcraft.
Yeah.
Which was... me doing away with a bottle of rum, starting to clean my act up
and
teaching family and friends stuff which was so common sense to me from a rural childhood, making whistles with a penknife and sliding stuff, all the way through to doing kids' birthday parties and just throwing a hat in the ring at what life might be like if we gave ourselves permission to have an outdoor business.
Yeah.
What might that look like?
Yeah.
And you've got to give yourself permission long before you actually do the thing.
Agree.
And then you've got to be brave enough to take action because nothing beats inaction faster than action.
Mm.
So you then start saying yes and figuring out how to do it.
Yep.
So you do that for a couple of years. Then you end up offering about 13 different products. Then you, whilst upskilling yourself. So I went and did year-long level fours in bushcraft leadership instruction, managed to find all the best schools, managed to get the Royal Marines Charity to help me. I then did ethnobotany, the study of trees, plants, flowers, their chemical constituents in relationship to us as humans. That covers herbal medicine, poisons, all sorts of extracting dyes, making ink from acorns, stuff we've done for millennia and our ancestors have done to a standard for us to be having this conversation today.
Yeah.
So
how exciting is that?
Well,
how many years has this business been running?
It's an eighth year.
Eighth year. And for any listeners out there, where can they find this business?
Well, you can just go on, type in Hidden Valley Bushcraft.
Mm.
Or you can now look at the Woodland Warrior Program. So what I ended up effectively doing was a bit of a bird's foot model. So three core products.
Yep.
And you can always afford to lose a toe if you use that analogy. So you've got Hidden Valley Bushcraft providing educational, recreational, overnight stays, working with cadet forces, colleges, individuals. I mean, I've literally been fortunate enough over the last couple of years to be speaking to everyone from ministerial level to kindergarten kids, where we had a product that became an Ofsted Outstanding Kindergarten.
Mm.
We had to let that go through lockdown and do a business pivot, which was smart thinking at the time, looking at the stats and the data, how much time and effort was going into that product versus what would that then release? That then became an off-grid cabin that now is a standalone experience that people can rent and stay in.
Where is that?
In our woodland in Somerset in the Chew Valley.
Okay. Chew Valley. So you bought a woodland in 2012?
I did, yeah.
And then that's part of your business model today?
We now own two sites.
Yep.
The other one's a small holding I've just set up. Using the same, so all the lessons I've learned about how a limited company and a community interest company can work in support of each other. So you've got your charitable, not-for-profit
CIC, and you've got your limited.
That's where I work with injured veterans and blue light services, and I provide a package that I never had.
Brilliant.
So that's how that's born. It's very organic.
What a lovely story.
That's your limited company that pays for Finley to go swimming. And then you've got me. I'm now the third toe. I'm now stepping out from under the brand. I'm now stepping into being me, getting out there, speaking, getting on bigger stages. I'm fortunate enough to be on the Eventful Lives podcast today with yourself, and things are growing. Yeah, there we go.
I've really enjoyed this episode.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for your honesty. Love the journey. Absolutely love the journey. You're a good man. Yeah.
Thanks, Dodge.
Cheers, mate. Take care. Hi, guys. I really hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Can you do us a favor and leave us a review, as it massively helps us grow the show? Cheers, guys.